From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and another big drop at the open on Wall Street this morning. More economic fallout from the Brexit referendum last week. Today in London, Prime Minister David Cameron addressed Parliament for the first time since the vote.
Of course, I don't take back what I said about the risks. It is going to be difficult. We've already seen that there are going to be adjustments within our economy, complex constitutional issues, and challenging new negotiation to undertake with Europe. But I am clear, and the Cabinet agreed this morning, that the decision must be accepted and the process of implementing the decision in the best possible way must now begin.
But Cameron said the official split wouldn't be triggered until after he steps down in October. Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. And Rob, Cameron is rejecting the idea that this could be reversed, but there are questions about that, about a way to avoid Brexit. Can you tell us about that?
I can't really, no. I mean, I suppose the only thing one could say is that I suppose there may be a chance that the absolute enormity of the possible consequences of leaving the European Union may have caused some in the Leave campaign to have some thoughts about it, because obviously we've seen in short order since that extraordinary vote, we've seen economic market turmoil in the UK, we've seen a threat from Scotland and even Northern Ireland to break away, and of course the issue of Britain's standing in the world and its relationship with particularly the rest of the European Union, the remainder of the European Union, look very, very awkward indeed. I mean, the only reason why I guess I would be somewhat sceptical about finding a way out is just that the Leave campaign stirred up 17 million people, you know, to get very enthusiastic about leaving the European Union. So it would be quite a tricky manoeuvre to pull off, Jeremy.
Well, what about the fact, and some people have pointed to this, that David Cameron, the Prime Minister, did not immediately invoke Article 50 the morning after the vote? That would be the way that the UK would actually go about leaving the EU legally, that was not invoked right away, and that it may be difficult for anyone else to actually do that, given all of the negative headlines that have come out of this.
Well, of course, you know, that's certainly the perspective of some who voted Remain, thinking maybe David Cameron has created a chance for those who won the referendum, if I could put it that way, to change their minds. But I keep going back to the sort of, you know, the popular politics of all of this. I mean, if you hold a referendum and you get everyone stirred up with the idea of leaving the European Union, that it will enable Britain to cut migration, but somehow to carry on trading perfectly well with Europe, but without all the bad stuff. I mean, it's going to be very difficult to walk away from that pledge. But, you know, I would add this, Jeremy. Absolutely nobody saw this coming. So, I mean, you could almost say, who knows what might happen next?
Well, one of the things that a piece of tape that's gone viral in this country since the Brexit is a journalist from a show called Good Morning Britain asking one of the big proponents of Brexit, Nigel Farage, the UKIP leader, if he could guarantee that one of the promises, that £350 million that Britain sends to the EU each week will be spent on the National Health Service as promised. And here's some of that tape.
No, I can't. And I would never have made that claim. And that was one of the mistakes, I think that the Leave campaign made.
Hang on a moment. That was one of your adverts.
Well, it wasn't one of my adverts, I can assure
you. Well, that was one of the Leave campaign's adverts.
That money was going to go
to the NHS.
And I think they made a mistake.
That's why many people have voted.
They made a mistake in doing that.
Are people feeling lied to?
Not yet, but I think it really has dawned on people that those politicians who campaigned for Britain to leave the European Union don't have a plan. And, you know, some people might find that rather shocking. Some people might say, well, that's only fair enough. What they were trying to do is to get Britain to exit from the EU. Could you really have expected them to have a precise roadmap for what comes ahead? But I think there may be some areas where Brexit voters may be disappointed, because Boris Johnson, for example, a prominent Conservative MP, thought very likely to be Mr. Cameron's successor. I mean, he wrote in a newspaper article today that you know, he didn't think necessarily that immigration was one of the big driving forces behind people that voted for Britain to leave. And I think that's going to come as an awful shock to some of the Brexit voters. And I think people will be very disappointed if they find that immigration doesn't come down.
Well, speaking of immigration, what does this mean for all of the Europeans who've come to the UK to live and to work under the existing rules? Are they wondering now whether they're going to be kicked out of the UK soon?
They are, although Boris Johnson did say in his newspaper column that, that just wouldn't happen. Any EU national here or Brits working abroad, absolutely nothing to worry about. And he seemed to kind of hint at a future where British people would still be able to work abroad and presumably some Europeans work here. But I throw in a thought at this point, Jeremy, that in a way it goes beyond that. And that is I have a very, very good friend who is French but was raised in North America. And she said to me the other day after the vote, you know, I still love Britain, but I'm not in love with Britain anymore. And actually, I think for the 3 million EU nationals who are living here, and this is not to say that the whole migration problem isn't something that politicians should have addressed and that there aren't lots of people here who are justifiably very unsettled by the large scale of migration from the EU. But I think that really does give you kind of pause for thought that some of the EU nationals living here, never mind their status, they maybe just sort of love Britain a bit less than they used to.
That's the BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson following the latest on the Brexit story from London. Rob, thank you so much.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, today in California, Sacramento police are investigating just what happened yesterday at that white supremacist rally at the state capitol, a rally that almost immediately turned into a brawl as protesters attacked the white supremacists who fought back. In total, 9 people went to the hospital. Matthew Heimbach, the chair of the supremacist group, the Traditionalist Worker Party, said afterwards, "We stood our ground, we will be back." And soon videos popped up reminding us he's the same person seen wearing a Make America Great Again cap, shoving a black woman, a Black Lives Matter protester, at a rally for Donald Trump. Ryan Lenz is a senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Ryan, you've been tracking Matthew Heimbach. Who is he?
Well, Matthew Heimbach is, I mean, he's the youthful face of hate in America. He is not that so many years removed from college, but he's been active on the racist radical right for many years. As a student at Towson University in 2013, he formed what he called the White Student Union to advocate for the interests of white students. And one of the more controversial realities behind that group was they would go out on these crime patrols where they were watching for black-on-white crime, quote-unquote. And while they were doing that, they would chalk the sidewalks with messages like white pride and white guilt is over. You know, from the cradle of these institutions, Heimbach has emerged as a very smart, a very savvy, and a very energizing figure for young people on the racist right.
Well, the group is called the Traditionalist Worker Party. It is a white nationalist group. It says on its website that it planned Sunday's event, yesterday's event, in conjunction with the Golden State Skinheads to make a statement about the precarious situation our race is in after brutal assaults at Donald Trump events in California. And as we're reminded, he was there when a Black Lives Matters woman was pushed and shoved. He was one of the people pushing and shoving. He says what about that incident?
Like most things Matthew Heimbach says, it, you know, involves these wonderful rhetorical gymnastics. I believe he says he was provoked at the Trump rally in Louisville. It's interesting to note about Heimbach's whole worldview. He disguises or conceals or covers up his racism through what he calls Christian love. He says that I don't hate anybody. I just love white people. It's a very interesting little twist.
Well, if you go to his Twitter, he has a little over 3,000 followers. Of course, you don't know if they're all supporters. They may be just looking to see what he says. But he writes of himself, he's chair of the only third position party in the U.S. fighting for faith, family and folk. And he spoke with Al Jazeera America last year about some of his beliefs. Let's listen.
I believe that every people deserves to have a sovereign homeland. They should be able to have their own space where their own culture and their own faith, family, and folk can thrive. And that's the belief of nationalism that is shared by most people and groups around the world.
Now, you say he is potentially the David Duke for a new generation, but not neo-Nazi.
Not neo-Nazi. He's not a Nazi in the context of the neo-Nazi movement. That's a very particular ideology that advocates for the resurgence of the Third Reich. There's all sorts of Nazi iconography, and I don't recall ever having seen Matthew Heimbach with a swastika anywhere on a piece of clothing.
Yeah.
However, a number of years ago, we started to notice that after Matt graduated from college, it was no longer just sort of this casual activism. He was rubbing shoulders and getting into bed with some very hardline racist organizations, including Nazi organizations like the National Socialist Movement. Mm. He's protested with other groups like the Aryan Terror Brigade. He has met with leaders of Golden Dawn, Greece's National Socialistic Party. And I don't think there's an ideology on the racist right that Matthew Heimbach has not danced through in some respects.
Well, and just very briefly, obviously he sees something in Donald Trump. He was at the rallies. Your thoughts on that?
Well, he's not the only racist in America to see something in Donald Trump. Trump's candidacy, which began famously with a call to build a wall on the U.S. border with Mexico and has tripped weirdly through other ideas like banning all Muslim immigration. These are ideas that resonate with racists in America. We've seen the white nationalist and white supremacist movements be energized in ways they have not in many years, maybe not since George Wallace's era in the South.
Ryan Lenz, senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you so much.
The artist Christo has realized a dream he's had for more than four decades. His latest project, The Floating Piers, is an almost two-mile-long walkway covered in yellow-orange fabric that stretches out into Lake Iseo in northern Italy. It connects two islands with the mainland. The project will be up for just 16 days. It closes on July 3rd, and then it will be dismantled and recycled. Christo expected about 45,000 visitors a day, but last week there were more than double that many, and the floating piers have had to be closed at nights for repairs. It's Christo's first large-scale project since he and his late wife, Jean-Claude, installed the gates in New York Central Park back in 2005. Their other projects include the Wrapped Coast in Australia, Wrapped Reichstag in Berlin, and Surrounded Islands in Miami back in 83. Christo joins us now via Skype from Lake Iseo in Italy. You'll have to listen closely because he's got a bit of an accent. But Christo, it is a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
So when did you and Jean-Claude first envision this project, and what was the original inspiration for it?
When first envisioned many, many years ago, which happened just after the wrapping of the coastline in Australia near Sydney, 1969. The first proposal for floating pier was for the delta of Rio de la Plata near Buenos Aires in Argentina. Hmm. Many of our projects, they deal with the connection between the fluidity of the water and sturdiness of the earth, like the Wrapped Coast in Australia, like the running fence going in the Pacific Ocean. Basically, all that play between fluidity and the water, earth, was very much in our work for many years.
And why was that so interesting to you, the difference between the water and the earth?
Visual artists understand something can move, something very sturdy. Very simple. And, of course, the connection, how the water play with the earth and with the rocks, with the surface, with static. Basically, there are a lot of dynamics.
And in this case, people can actually walk out onto the floating piers.
That was the idea. Basically, in 1970, there was the proposal to build pontoon type. We put in wooden floor and cover with fabric, and the people will walk. Of course, the pontoon will move because it's not totally solid structure. Fortunately, we don't did that project at that time, but technology today to translate the motion of the water is so much more advanced, and I come later. Now, in 1995, we finished the Reichstag, and Jean-Claude and myself was always thinking about that project that we like to do people walking in the water, and we spent a lot of time in Japan. And we were looking for tranquil water that we can do the project. And the second attempt to do floating pier was in the Tokyo Bay, an area of Daiba. And we worked very hard between 1996 and 1997. But again, we failed to get permission from the government in Tokyo. And now Jean-Claude passed away in 2009. I am working on a project for a long time, the project for Mastaba, and United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi since 1979, the project over the river since 1996. And of course, these two projects, they entangle with permitting process, with very complicated. And I say to my friend that I will become 8 years old in 2015, and I like to do something can happen very fast. Now, between 1958 and 64, we live in Paris, but we exhibit many times in Italy, and we did exhibition in Milano, Torino, Venezia, and Rome. And this is how we were scouting the lakes I know. We were looking for tranquil water, basically, lake. And right away, Lake Iseo was most suitable for our project. The lake have, in the middle of the lake, very tall island. It's called actually Mountain Monte Isola. Now, the idea was to connect the mainland with the islands, because in that islands, 2,000 people live, their houses and villages, and these people go from the island to the mainland by traghetto, by boat. They do not have a bridge. And this is how all the projects start. Taking the island of Monte Isola, connecting it with the mainland and eastern part of the lake with the town of Sulzano, and created 3 kilometers. I only say in kilometers, don't ask me to convert in feet. 3 kilometers of the floating pier and 2.5 kilometers of pedestrian street. Now, in the early years, the floating pier was built by the typical pontoon, like everybody know, with wooden floor. But early 2000, Canadian engineer invented very intelligent, very simple system to create a pier who literally float, built by the system of the extruded cube. And they connected with giant screw. This is why they're very difficult to explain you how the surface works, because you need to experience. It's like, almost like walking in the water.
Well, and as I hear you describe that, I also think about the enormous part of this project, which is just getting the funding, setting up the amount of money. This was a 16-point-something million-dollar project. That must take up a lot of your time as well.
You know, I understand we need to sell works, but fortunately, Jean-Claude and myself, we're the biggest collector of our work. Our principal storage is in Basel, Switzerland, and that is the golden mine we work from late 50 to today. And this is why it allows us to be very free, independently sell the works and build this project. Yes.
Why not leave this project up permanently?
All our projects, they designed to be temporary. There are some permanent works, you know, works where the museum and collection, they're permanent, they stay forever. But that project, they're not only designed temporary, they designed for particular season of the year. Like the Central Park project was winter project. We like to have a lively street to see the gates. During the summertime, Central Park is like forest. When the Miami project and Florida 1983 surrounded island was spring project, because before the hurricanes come in Miami later in the season. And of course, that project is summer project, the floating pier. We have the longest daylight of the year, end of June. All the journey is the work of art. All the journey from the beginning to the end is the work of art. And the most beautiful part of floating pier that I discover is to see entire project is about the people walking nowhere. About the feeling of the surface of the land or the water. And your feet, actually, many of the people walk barefoot. And they walk. It's not like going to shop, not going to see your friends. It's going really nowhere.
And what was it like in this case to complete this project without your longtime wife and partner, Jean-Claude, who, as you said, died in 2009?
I miss her all the time, you know. She loved that project very much. She was a very dynamic woman. You know? She was never stopped. She can never sit. She's moving all the time. And she was really very energetic. And, of course, this is why this project is so much still with her, you know.
I read that the two of you wouldn't fly on the same planes because
one
of the planes crashed, you wanted to make sure that the other person would be able to continue the work.
Exactly, yes.
So what's next? You've talked about the Mastaba, this permanent project, right?
You asked me to talk about the future and a very unfortunate moment. I have only remaining few days to be with our baby. I don't like to think about anything else except that project. I have these 16 days to enjoy it from morning to night, the middle of the night. It's all about that project.
You talk about how this project can be felt by those who are able to walk along it. But I also want to say that one of the amazing images that I've seen, or many of them, are from the air. That, and a lot of your projects, they look really incredible, and you see them in a different way from above.
But really, the project should be walk. Of course, for the photograph, for the newspaper, they're photographing for the air. And much of the pictures there before the project is open on June 18th. Today, you cannot see anything of that. We see it from helicopter. It's full. It's like an incredible amount of people. And this is the most greatest pleasure. It's entirely motion of people walking.
So you don't think about what it's going to look like from above?
No, I enjoy it. I never take the helicopter, actually, really. I have no time. Entire project is designed, basically, it's like a huge boulevard or avenue. And this is why, against that organic shape of the island and curve, organic shape, you have this very straight line created rencontre of several piers, like an area called the star, when three piers meet together. I just coming back on the boat when I was looking from the boat how that connection happened. It's very exciting. It's an incredible play of the immensity of the water with people walking in the water. The color of the fabric is dahlia yellow, but around the edge of the pier is continually wet, and of course the color is darker, mostly orangey, like a brick dark color orangey, with very painterly surface. And the people do not walk on the wet side. They really walk on the dry side. It's almost like abstract painting.
Is this the project that you're most proud of that you've ever done?
No, all of our projects, they're part of our life, you know. They're part of moment of our life, Jean-Claude and myself.
Well, Christo, congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
More trouble in global markets today following the United Kingdom's vote to leave the European Union. Today, George Osborne, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, tried to reassure investors.
It will not be plain sailing in the days ahead. But let me be clear. You should not underestimate our resolve. We were prepared for the unexpected, and we are equipped for whatever happens.
So what might happen in the country that many have thought for years would be the first to leave the EU? Greece. NPR's Joanna Kakissis is in Athens. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what is the conversation like in Athens today? How are people reacting to the decision? Because Greece is a country that many have been looking to wonder whether they're going to leave the EU as well.
Yeah, there's been a lot of shock here because, you know, many Greeks are used to their country being the reason for chaos in the markets and in Europe and in the world. You know, and I've heard people say, hey, for once, we're not seen as causing all the problems. It's been strange, you know, for people here to see Great Britain, which they, you know, which they see as say is known for its cool-headedness. It's now in the center of the proverbial storm in Europe. Many Greeks thought the British would vote to stay in the EU because they see the UK as sort of a bedrock of European identity. And to see so many divisions in the UK over the European Union, and to see all the xenophobia, to hear that some of the British want to keep out migrants from poor EU countries, that's been really hard for Greeks to hear. Because Greeks have been studying and working in the UK for years. I know so many people here who have gotten undergraduate degrees, graduate degrees, you know, and it'll be so much harder and more expensive to do that now that it looks like Great Britain will leave the EU.
Well, has the Brexit vote reignited calls for a Grexit from the Euro and from the European Union by Greece?
No, not at the moment. No one's actually calling for a referendum on leaving or, you know, a question of whether they should leave or remain in the EU. But, you know, there is concern that the instability of Britain withdrawing from the EU could mean that Greece could be marginalized within the union. You know, some Greeks are concerned that the EU after this Brexit could become more insular. And Greece is already the pariah of the Eurozone, you know, still in a deep economic depression and still deeply in debt. So some are worried that the Eurozone Eurozone leaders will just lose the will to keep managing this never-ending debt crisis. And some Eurozone leaders, you know, they think Greece has been too slow to reform its economy. So, you know, some people here worry that they could just let Greece default and cut their losses.
And what about the economic impact on Greece from the Brexit? What do we know at this point? We've been watching the stock market here in the United States just plummet ever since the vote on Thursday. What's happening in Greece and what are the fears about how this could impact tourism in Greece? Because a lot of Brits go and spend time on the Greek islands.
That's right. You know, the stock market took a huge hit here as well. And, you know, there's been concern about Greek exports to the UK if they're going to go down. But you're right. Tourism is the big thing because, you know, the British are the second most popular tourist to Greece after the Germans. And the British spend somewhere between 55% to 60% more than other tourists here. And they represent about 10% of total tourism to Greece and about 14% of total travel receipts. So if the pound stays weak, then they won't be spending as much or staying as long in Greece is relying heavily on tourism revenue to help keep it afloat as the country enters its seventh year of recession.
That's NPR's Joanna Kakissis joining us from Athens as we watch the fallout across Europe from the Brexit vote. Joanna, thanks.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
And there was a huge decision today from the Supreme Court on abortion. In a 5-3 decision, the court struck down a Texas law and reversed a lower court ruling. The law required health clinics that performed abortions have surgical facilities, and doctors who perform the abortions have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. Since both of those requirements were very hard to do, many clinics in Texas closed, and it became very difficult for women in parts of Texas to get any health care and to get abortions. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving has been looking at all of today's decisions, this on the last day of this year's session. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Robin.
And start with the Texas ruling. You know, tell us more about how the court voted, what the justices said.
It was a 5-3 decision with Justice Stephen Breyer writing the majority opinion and invoking the spirit and the letter of a 1992 decision by the court in a case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which was a landmark case, perhaps the most important case after Roe versus Wade in 1973, legalized abortion nationwide. This is maybe the third in that line, because what the justices said today was that these laws that have been passed in recent years, specifically targeting abortion providers with a lot of restrictions that don't apply to anyone else who provides health care outside of a hospital, are really just undue burdens on the right to an abortion, deliberate obstacles in the path of an abortion. And those terms are significant because they were in that 1992 decision.
And what was the dissent?
The dissent came from three justices, of course, the Chief, John Roberts, also Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. Interestingly, though, Clarence Thomas was the one who really said that these parts of this Texas law that required surgical procedure facilities in any clinic that was going to provide abortions, or that required doctors providing abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, were okay. We're just perfectly fine. The other two dissenting justices, Roberts and Alito, said, look, maybe we should send this back down to Texas and see if there's any evidence that the decrease in the number of clinics providing abortions from 40 down to 20 had to do with the passage of these restrictions, or whether there were some other explanation. They were basically buying some time, perhaps to get back to a time when they might have nine justices on the court.
Well, but they don't right now, an 8-member court. What kind of effect will this ruling have across the country? I mean, how many other states have laws like Texas had?
These restrictions, TRAP, they're sometimes called Targeted Restrictions on Abortion Providers, or TRAP laws, started out in the Midwest and in Texas. In 2000, there were 11 states with them. By 2014, we had 23 states with them. They have been very popular in legislatures that are heavily Republican in the South and in the Midwestern states. And those states now are going to have to show why their particular TRAP laws are different from Texas's, and because most all of them are modeled on the same sort of idea of requiring surgical facilities and admitting privileges, it would appear logical that they will not withstand a challenge in those other states either, given these Supreme Court guidelines.
Okay. The court had two other decisions. They ruled on the federal corruption conviction of former Virginia Governor Robert McDonnell, throwing out that conviction. That means he won't have to serve the 2 years of prison time he was sentenced to. But what else does it mean about corruption convictions and public figures?
First off, it vacates the sentence of 2 years for former Governor McDonnell. It is possible the prosecutors will take the new guidelines from this Supreme Court decision and say they're going to take another swing at it. Mm. I don't know that we would anticipate that, but it is at least possible. It also sends a signal to perhaps all other prosecutors considering going after a public official that, and I'm quoting here from the decision, just setting up a meeting, talking to another official, or organizing an event without more does not meet that definition of official act. So a governor or a member of Congress or a legislator who has had a lot of commerce with a particular constituent, taken gifts from that person, been having a very cozy relationship with them, but has only set up meetings for that person and never actually done something that was an official act, such as passing a bill or making a ruling of some kind, cannot be said to have been bribed or to have been corrupted. That is going to set the bar a little higher for prosecutors and probably for investigative reporters as well.
Hmm. Well, Ron, we have about a minute here. There was another big ruling in many eyes. The court upheld the law that restricts people convicted of domestic violence from owning guns. There were two men, I believe, from Maine who'd said that they should have the ability to have a gun, even though they had domestic abuse charges. What was the vote here?
The vote here was 6-2, yeah. Not a close vote. Mm-hmm. And here again, Justice Thomas was kind of the outlier, saying that he saw no problem with giving these gun rights back to these two individuals. Mm-hmm. The distinction here was that they said they shouldn't be affected by the federal gun ban because their domestic abuse had been reckless conduct, quote unquote, and not intentional conduct, pushing, shoving, a little slapping with their domestic partners. But it should not have been considered intentional abuse. The court disagreed with them 6-2, so they have lost their right to purchase guns or own guns.
NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
So that is it for this term of the Supreme Court, which started with 9 justices and ended with 8 after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. And that vacancy is just one of many in the federal courts, thanks in part to the increasingly political nature of the judicial system. Of all the current openings, the longest is in North Carolina, as Jeff Tiberi from Here and Now contributor WUNC reports.
It has been more than a decade since a federal judicial vacancy came open in the district that serves 44 counties in eastern North Carolina.
December 31, 2005, Eastern District of North Carolina Judge Malcolm Howard assumed senior status.
That's University of Richmond law professor Carl Tobias. He says after decades on the bench, judges receive senior status. The idea is to give them a sort of retirement and work new blood into the court system. But Tobias says it hasn't happened.
That vacancy has remained open for 3,800 days.
Quick math off the top of my head, 10 years, 12 months, 120 months plus 4 months. It's, I think, 124 months as well.
Yes.
You're laughing. Why is this amusing, or why are you laughing?
Well, it isn't funny for the judges of the Eastern District or the people who live there. So I guess it's just pathetic is what it is. Maybe I shouldn't be laughing because it is serious.
Of all 90 federal judicial vacancies in the United States, none has been empty longer than North Carolina's Eastern District, 4 years longer than any other unoccupied seat. The Eastern District has allocated 4 full-time judges, but for more than a decade, it has been operating with 3.
It puts more pressure on the other judges. It means that civil trials take longer to secure for litigants. Evidence becomes stale. People don't have their day in court. Justice delayed is justice denied.
An official with the Eastern District declined to do a recorded interview, but she did say that senior judges are being pressed hard. Judge Carol Fox is currently working a full caseload. He turns 88 this fall. This is what amounts to a judicial emergency, at least according to the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts, law experts like Professor Tobias, and staffers within the Eastern District. They say help is needed. North Carolina's senior U.S. Senator Richard Burr sees it differently.
We converse with the judges on the bench, and there is not a judicial emergency from the standpoint of their caseload.
Before a nominee can gain congressional approval, U.S. senators must turn in their blue slips. Burr has refused to do so. Meanwhile, President Obama has nominated Patricia Timmons Goodson. She is the second African-American woman Obama has nominated for this seat.
To make a nomination right now is overtly political, and that's all it is, and I think they have admitted it as well. There's never been district court judges nominated this late that ever got consideration out of the United States Senate.
Timmons Goodson is a former state Supreme Court justice and widely respected. But just as U.S. senators have blocked federal appellate judge Merrick Garland from the high court, there will be no progress on her nomination. This issue is already a topic in Burr's reelection bid playing out. G.K. Butterfield is a congressman from North Carolina's 1st District. That includes portions of the Eastern District.
Well, it certainly is political. We all know that. And it smells of racism.
Like the nominee for this vacancy, Butterfield is African-American. And he points out that the Eastern District has never had an African-American judge on the bench.
The judiciary must be a diverse institution. We cannot have an all-white federal district court in the Eastern District of North Carolina that is 35% African-American. And that is unacceptable.
Whether or not this lingering vacancy is motivated by race, politics, or some combination of both, one thing is clear. The void is unlikely to be filled anytime before the election. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Tiberi.
Hillary Clinton took her presidential campaign to Cincinnati, Ohio today, and by her side, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, their first joint appearance on the trail. Clinton sang Warren's praises but didn't make any major announcement, although there's a lot of expectation she will. Should she? Anthony Brooks from Here and Now contributor WBUR takes a look at the pros and cons of a Clinton-Warren ticket.
There are a number of reasons why Clinton should pick Elizabeth Warren, if you ask Andrew Green, the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Last week, he published an editorial with the title, "The Case for Clinton Warren." Reason number one, Green says Clinton needs to reach progressives and tap into the kind of political passion that fueled Bernie Sanders' campaign.
And Elizabeth Warren certainly could help do that, in that she hits a lot of the same issues that Senator Sanders does in terms of income inequality, that the system is rigged against regular people. And she has the intellectual and policy chops to really make those cases and has been doing so very well for years.
Another important reason to pick Warren, according to Green, she's a good person to have by your side in a fight.
Senator Warren has shown herself to be a really exquisite attack dog against Donald Trump.
Indeed, Warren seems to delight in this role, which is an important one for a running mate to take on. Here she is earlier today in Cincinnati, where she introduced Clinton and launched a blistering takedown of Donald Trump.
What kind of a man roots for people to lose their jobs, to lose their homes, to lose their life savings? I'll tell you what kind of a man. A small, insecure money grubber who fights for no one but himself.
Warren frequently engages Trump on Twitter, calling him a bully who spews hate-filled lies. Trump calls her goofy and Pocahontas, a reference to the controversy surrounding her claims of Native American heritage. Here's Trump earlier this month in Richmond, Virginia.
Pocahontas, I'm doing such a disservice to Pocahontas. It's so unfair to Pocahontas. But this Elizabeth Warren, I call her goofy, Elizabeth Warren, she's one of the worst senators in the entire United States Senate, and I hope she's going to be chosen by Hillary. Oh, would that be great? I would love it.
But there are reasons why that might not happen. Though they're campaigning today in Ohio, Warren and Clinton haven't always been very close. Warren remained neutral during most of the long primary fight against Bernie Sanders, waiting until the very end to endorse Clinton. And in her 2003 book, Warren said Clinton's cozy connections with Wall Street caused her to flip her position on the overhaul of the country's bankruptcy laws. And if Clinton were to tap Warren, she could lose support from Wall Street donors. But Barney Frank, the former Massachusetts congressman and a Clinton supporter, says picking a woman to run with would be a bold step in a political season that demands boldness.
For Hillary Clinton to do something which would be very unconventional, a two-woman ticket, whereas in the past that might have been a problem, I think it would benefit her. It would help shadow this inaccurate stereotype that she's too timid.
On the other hand, a ticket of two Northeastern liberals would lack geographic or ethnic balance, an argument that might prompt Clinton to pick someone like HUD Secretary Julio Castro, who has a reputation as a rising Latino political star. But it's important to remember that this doesn't come down only to whether Clinton wants Warren to be her vice president.
It's really about, does Elizabeth Warren want to be vice president? And I think if you're a progressive Democrat, you hope the answer to that is no.
Susan Tracy is a former Massachusetts Democratic state rep. She says Warren is better off staying put in the Senate.
You know, she's really taken on the torch from Ted Kennedy. She has so much power and so much influence and such an important role to play in progressive politics. And quite honestly, I think that would be lost as a vice president.
But the speculation will continue today as Clinton and Warren campaign together in Cincinnati. And however unlikely a Clinton-Warren ticket is, that speculation helps both of them. It allows Clinton to say to progressives, hey, I'm considering one of your champions as my running mate. And it allows Warren to raise a very high political profile even higher. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
And now just a quick note on last night's BET Awards. Grey's Anatomy actor Jesse Williams stopped the show with an almost 6-minute speech on police brutality and racism.
I don't want to hear any more about how far we've come when paid public servants can pull a drive-by on a 12-year-old playing alone in a park in broad daylight, killing him on television and then going home to make a sandwich. Tell Rakia Boyd how it's so much better to live in 2012 than it is to live in 1612 or 1712. Tell that to Eric Garner. Tell that to Sandra Bland. Tell that to Dorian Hunt.
Williams received BET's Humanitarian Award and dedicated it to activists, civil rights attorneys, struggling parents, and students. Audience members, as you heard, applauded throughout. Social media exploded. We'll link you to his speech at hereandnow.org. And the social media craze continued during Jennifer Hudson's tribute to Prince.
Purple rain. Can y'all sing it with me? Purple rain.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.